All right, good evening, everyone. Welcome back. Chabura tonight is being done remotely due to some scheduling conflicts. Just going forward, you know, we're going into the summer months now. You know, there will be Chabura every week. You know, Chas v'Shalom, we have a week without Chabura, without learning. Just because of scheduling conflicts that arise over the summer, people are away, etc., we'll go week to week in terms of whether we do the Chabura in person in BTU or we do it remotely as we're doing right now and send out the recording. So I guess I would just say stay tuned week to week, whether it's done remotely like this or we do an in-person Chabura in Shul. All right, Parshas Balosra, Tav Shin Ayin Tes. The Chabura tonight is actually sponsored for Refuah Shalema for all the Cholim in the community, and also by Jake Wyman and SheerEnjoyment.com as a happy birthday to the Saunders, to Jesse and Dovie Saunders. So happy birthday to them. All right. So Parshas Balosra, Tav Shin Ayin Tes. Probably one of the most jam-filled Parshas in the entire Torah. A disclaimer, it's impossible to do justice to this parsha in 40 minutes. I could spend that on any one of a few dozen topics contained in these few prokim, but we'll do our best to highlight the main ideas and then zero in on a few ideas that were meaningful, at least to me. All right, a quick summary as we always do. The parsha begins with Hashem instructing Aaron HaKohen regarding the daily lighting of the menorah, and we're going to discuss what's going on beneath the surface there. Also, the Leviim are finally formally initiated into the Avoda and the Mishkan. For this, they needed to shave, to be tovel in a mikvah, bring various karbanos. And the Torah stresses that this was done in the stead of the Bechoros, because they were nichshol by the Egel Azov. We then have the inyan of Pesach Sheni, certain Jews who are tamei, and therefore couldn't bring the initial karban on Pesach itself. They complain to Moshe Rabbeinu they don't want to lose out. So Hashem creates Pesach Sheni to be observed 1 month after actual Pesach. And we'll discuss a certain aspect of that. So now, finally, Klal Yisrael journey away from Har Sinai. The Torah stresses that the Mishkan was Kisa Ha'anonis HaMishkan La'ol Ha'edus Uva Erev Yia Al HaMishkan Kamari Eish. It was covered by the Anon, the cloud by day, and by the Eish at night. And they traveled when and where Hashem told them to. Al pi Hashem Yisu b'nei Yisrael, al pi Hashem Yachanu. Sometimes there was a day or two that they stayed in one place. Sometimes it could be years. And then we discussed the chatzotzros, the trumpets of Moshe Rabbeinu, used to assemble Klal Yisrael together for travel or for war, and also when certain karbanos tzibur were being brought. And we're going to have a closer look tonight at the chatzotzros. And then, upon leaving Har Sinai, Moshe Rabbeinu pleads with Yisro, his father-in-law, to come with them to Eretz Yisrael, but he refuses. And we're also going to dive a little bit deeper into that. And as the Mefarshim say, here was Klal Yisrael. They were primed to enter Eretz Yisrael as soon as 3 days out, say many of the Mefarshim. That's how close they were. And then we have the Parsha of Vayehi ben Soa, bracketed by the famous upside-down nuns, which the Mefarshim explain, represents its own Sefer of Vayehi ben Soa, detailing how history should have been, that Klal Yisrael would now proudly march into Eretz Yisrael, led by the Aron Kodesh, and Vayafutsu Oyvecha, our enemies would scatter from before us, right? The Balaturim, very interesting, writes based on the Sifri, that Nun, the Gematria of 50, represents the Yardain, which was 50 Amos wide, representative of the fact that Hashem was literally about to have them cross the Yardain into Eretz Yisrael. But unfortunately, those Nuns are inverted, representative of the fact that at the last moment, it all goes to pieces. This beautiful ideal of Vayehi ben Soa goes awry, and the Torah jumps right into Vayehi ha'am kemis onanim. They start to travel, and almost immediately they start to complain, right? First about the desert travel being too hard, and then about the food. They wanted meat. They were sick of the man, and Moshe Rabbeinu is fed up. Lo uchal anochi levadi lasesis kol am hazeh ki chaved mimeni. These people are too much for me. They're literally children. And if this is how it's gonna be, v'im kacha at osa li hargeni na harog. The phrase we all use sometimes in times of difficulty and frustration. You know, just shoot me already. Just kill me. But Hashem calms him down. He gives Moshe the zakenim to help him carry the load. And if we have time, I heard a nice idea on the role of the Zekanim. We'll talk about that. And Hashem gives Klal Yisrael the meat, the famous slav, translated as quail, ad asher yetze me'apchem, until it comes out of their noses to the point that it was nauseating. And finally, when Hashem appointed the Zekanim, he instilled in them a piece of Moshe's own nevuah skills. The pasuk says, v'yotzalti min aruach asher alecha v'samti aleihem. Right? So Eldad and Medad, who had foregone being appointed to the Zekanim such that no one else should be overlooked, right? We have 70 Zekanim divided by 12 Shvatim means that two had to be left out, right? Because that comes to 72, which means two had to be left out somewhere. So it was them, it was Eldad and Medad, but they still got Nevuah. Some say as a schus for voluntarily stepping aside, they still got Nevuah. So they began to prophesize in the machne, in the camp. And Yeshua takes exception to this. He wants them thrown in jail. Adoni Moshe kila aim. But Moshe has the opposite reaction. Hamikane atali umiyitein kol am Hashem neviim. Don't be jealous for me. Halavai, all of Bnei Yisrael should be neviim. Moshe sees it as a good thing. And finally, the Torah describes how this negative attitude of complaining eventually reached Miriam and Aaron themselves, who spoke negatively about Moshe, that he married an Isha Cushis, and he remained celibate, and that they too were neviim. Vayomru harak ach b'Moshe diber Hashem. Halo gambanu diber. Right? Well, Hashem spoke to us too. And as we all know, Miriam had to endure tzaras for 1 week while all of Klal Yisrael waited for her to travel again. And we learn about Moshe's special nevuah, how it was unique, and how also Moshe was anov ma'od, mikol adam asher al pnei ha'adam. Moshe was the most modest person who ever lived, the greatest anov. And we're going to explain that a bit, how that possibly can be so. So, you know, overall, in summation, it's a sad parsha, really. You have Vayihi ben Soa, which was intended to be its own sefer, detailing the beginning of the happy ending, if you will, to the Torah. And then all these horrible stories seem to snowball. Baloscha, Shlach, Korach, Chukas, Balach, Pinchas, Matas, Maseh, all contain story after story of our ancestors messing up. And that snowball continues until this day, to the Golus where we find ourselves, unfortunately, right here and right now. You know, I always joke with my wife that every fight we've had now in almost 10 years of marriage has occurred when it's hot, you know, when the AC isn't working or it's humid and it's sticky, and that always leads sometimes to a fight. And so too here, these summer parshios of Balos, Chashlach, Korach, Chukas, Balak detail a very drastic fall from grace. And what started it? What started it? Vayihi am k'misonanim, says the Mefarshim, they were hot. The Misonanim, they didn't want to be in the desert anymore. It was, this desert life was not good for them. So that's my own little upshot, but that's a synopsis of Baloscha. A lot of storylines here. That would be a gross understatement. This is probably the longest summary of a parsha I ever gave to start a chabura. It just shows how much material there is here. So let's not take up any more time with a summary. Let's dive right in to a couple of targeted ideas. So the parsha begins with a very famous Rashi. We just discussed last week about how the Torah typically doesn't ask about smichas aparshios unless there's a stark contrast based on the Maral, if you recall. But we have one here again tonight from Rashi to start things off. Lama nismucha parshas ha-menorah le-parshas ha-nesiyim. Right? We immediately jump from the very lengthy discussion of the Nesiyim's karbonos for the Chanukah Samizbeach into a discussion of Hashem teaching Aaron HaKohen how to light the menorah on a daily basis. Why, asks Rashi? They seem to have nothing to do with each other. Lefi kishira Aaron Chanukas HaNesiyim cholsha daito. Aaron was upset that he and the Leviim didn't take part in that mass hakrava of karbanos. Right, as we all know, the Nesiyim were the kapos in Mitzrayim. They were the intermediary between the Egyptian guards and the Jewish people. And very often, when the work wasn't done, or even if it was done, they took beatings. So in that schus, they became the Nesiyim. And they were given this special kavod. But Shevet Levi wasn't part of the Shibud. So they didn't have a Nasi in that context and in that same sense. So therefore, they missed out on this special honor from Parshas Noso. So Aaron was sad because they didn't have that special schus of being Moser Nefesh for other Jews like the rest of the Shvatim did. Or rather, the rest of the Shvatim's Nesiyim did. And he was jealous of that. But Hashem comforts him. Don't worry. Chayecha, says Rashi, shelcha gedola mishalahem, shato madlik umetiv esaneros. Your portion for you and the Leviim is still greater than the other Shvatim. Why? Because, okay, they have these karbonos, true. But you, the Leviim, Aaron, you're madlik the neros on the menorah. And with that, Aaron was comforted. So several questions. Number one, why was Aaron upset? As the Ramban writes, "V'lo nachmu b'ktoras boker v'chol karbonos u'minchos chavitin uva'odas yom ha'kipurim she'en akshera ela bo v'nichnas l'fnai v'lifnim v'shu kodesh Hashem omed be'chalu l'sharso l'varech b'shmo v'shifto kulo m'sharsei elokeinu." right? Aaron had all of these extremely lofty jobs that no one else had. He went lifnai v'lifnim. He brought the minchas chavitin. He had shehikriv b'yamim ahem karbonos harbe kol yemei hamiluim, right? Even the karbonos of the Nesiim. Who brought the karbonos of the Nesiim? They brought it, but who was makriv them in the base of Migdash? The Kohanim. So even, you know, with regard to the karbonos of the Nesiim, Aaron was the one who was makriv them. And Aaron went lifnai v'lifnim. And Aaron had all these jobs vis-a-vis his role as the Kohen Gadol that that other people didn't have. So that wasn't enough. They had to participate in everything. It sounds like my kids. Like, I know I have this ice cream and this bicycle, and I got to stay up late when nobody else did, but my brother has chips. So I want chips too. And if I don't get it, I'll get all upset. That's what Aaron sounds like here. He had all these jobs. He had all these lofty positions. And the one thing he doesn't have, chol shadaito, he gets all upset. So why? That's question number one. And question number two, what does the menorah have to do with his chalisha sadas? If that's all Aaron needed, another job, then why the menorah specifically was used by Hashem as his comfort to satisfy his concern? So obviously there's a lot of panemius here. What's going on? So the Ramban answers this question. We mentioned the Ramban is the one who asks it, so he answers his own question based on the Ran, that all of these jobs that Aaron HaKohen had, he knew Beruach HaKodesh that there would come a day where the Beis HaMikdash and the Mishkan would not stand, it would be destroyed. And all of these things, the Minchas Chavitin and the Avodah of Yom Kippur and all these special jobs that he had would all become temporarily null and void. And this was upsetting to him. And he wanted to engage in something that was Lidoros, something that would endure the test of times. And he surmised that maybe these karbanos of the Nesiim offered a taste of that. To which Hashem responds to him, you want something that's Lidoros? You want something that's forever? Light the menorah. Because even when the Beis HaMikdash does not stand, what will we have in those times, in our times now, when we don't have the Beis HaMikdash, in the times of darkness, what do we have? We have Hanukkah. And those Neros will indeed be Mekuyim Lidoros throughout the years of darkness and Hester Panim and throughout the generations. So upon hearing this, that don't worry, Aaron, your actions won't just be blown over with the dust of time, that your descendants, the Chashmonoim, will lift up the Jewish people in their darkest of hours, that they too, like the Nesiim, the Kapos, so to speak, of Mitzrayim, the Chashmonoim too will be Moser Nefesh for Klal Yisrael in the story of Hanukkah. But even more so, the Nesiim did it just for then, in the moment, but the Chashmonoim, the Yontiv of Hanukkah, will lift Jews up forever. So then, when he heard that, then and only then was Aaron comforted. So what we see from here, the lesson is that the focus of Aaron, and thereby what should be our focus as well, should not be on the karbonos of the Nesiim, which as beautiful as they were one-time events, but rather we need to focus on things that are long-term, that are legacy events, that are lidoros, forever. So to focus on things that we pass on to our children and our grandchildren and our neighbors and our friends, a legacy, much more than one event or one particular item that may come up over the course of a lifetime. Other answers as well, the Or Chaim and the Netziv have similar answers, that Aaron was comforted by getting the Hadlakas Menorah because why? Kol yom ka'osem maisa chadosh. Every day was something new. Every day he had to clean out the old gunk from yesterday's hadlaka and get it ready for today's hadlaka. Right? Certain aspects of Kedusha are wonderful, but they can get tedious. But the menorah was a davar chadosh every day, and that appealed to Aaron. And the Tziv adds, he says the same thing, but he adds, da menorah tachlisa lepilpula shel Torah. Right? Shemen, right? Oil, as we all know, represents Torah. So the menorah represents the constant kindling of the light of Torah, and way above all of the avod of the Kohanim, what is the ultimate Lidoros endeavor? Torah. Torah is the ultimate Lidoros endeavor. So Hashem was giving Aaron the biggest, forever, the biggest Lidoros job of all, the generational bracha of Torah, giving Torah over to Klal Yisrael, inspiring Klal Yisrael, bringing them light, literally. And Torah is never old. Torah is never tedious. And with that job in hand, Aaron was comforted. So, what can we as simple Jews take away from here? And I think it's very simple. You know, we see here what mattered most to Aaron HaKohen was engaging in things that are Lidoros, being Moser Nefesh for the Torah, and being Moser Nefesh for the Torah well-being of other Jews, like the Nesiim did, and like the Chol Shmonoim were eventually destined to do, right? Engaging in Inyanei Ruchnius that have a long-term impact, not actions that are fleeting with time. And also, secondly, engaging in actions that also involve his Chadshus, doing something new all the time in our Avodas Hashem, keeping it fresh. And what's the best way to do all the above? Torah, which is the ultimate Lidoros activity. And Torah is always new and exciting, and it always offers all of the opportunity to, like the menorah, bring light to all the Jews around us. That's what we're doing right here and right now. So, you know, if those were the things that were crucial to Aaron, they should be crucial to all of us as well. That's the takeaway. So, Mirtz Hashem, we can model this in ourselves for the long term. And Be'ezor Hashem, bizochet to all the brachos and yeshuos that come vis-a-vis the menorah and the brilliant aura of Torah itself. So that's number one. So let's go weiter in what we just said. Right, the parsha begins that Aaron was so upset, he had chalishas adas to miss out on the karbonos and the siyim, even though as the Kohen Gadol, Aaron already had his hands on many different slices of the Kedusha pie, if you will. So, you know, well beyond the exposure of any other typical Jew at the least. So why was he upset? Why do you have chalishas adas? So he just explained it in depth, but even more simply, on a very high level, it's because Aaron, more than anyone, had a crystal clear understanding of the priceless value embedded in each and every mitzvah. So he was very troubled by the mere suggestion that he or Shevet Levi, Bichlal, might be missing out in any shape or form on Torah. Right? Torah is too valuable to sit on the sidelines, ever, full stop. So Aaron didn't want to miss anything. And the point, Dafka, this is Dafka, the connector to the next sugya in our parsha, that of Pesach Sheni. Right, Klal Yisrael were bringing the carbon Pesach in the Midbar, and lo and behold, vayihi an nashim asher ayu tameim lenefesh adam, v'lo yachlu lasos haPesach. Right, there were individuals who were tamei over the actual yontiv of Pesach. They came in contact with a dead body. Machlokes, what exactly that was? Some say these were Mishol and Eltzafan, the people that removed the bodies of Nadav and Avihu from the Mishkan. Some say they were the people who carried Yosef's coffin throughout the travels in the Midbar, and others say they were just random Jews, but were involved in the mitzvah with a random mace mitzvah on Pesach. But whatever shita you subscribe to, from what they did, they had contracted tumas mace, albeit vis-a-vis a mitzvah in all three cases, whether it's Nadav and Avihu, the bones of Yosef, or a mace mitzvah. But you know, rules are rules, and halachos are halachos, and thereby, per the halacha, they could not bring their own carbon Pesach at that time. So they were none too happy about this, and they complained to Moshe and Aaron, Lama Nigara, why should we lose out on the mitzvah of Karban Pesach? All right, that's our theme so far. Mitzvahs are so precious. Look at what Aaron HaKohen did, you know, just to ensure he didn't miss anything, not even one iota of Torah. And so to us, we don't want to miss out on one iota. And even further, you know, we didn't just contract Tumas Meis. It was only in the fulfillment of another mitzvah. So Lama Nigara, why should we miss out when we know that, you know, mitzvah gereres, mitzvah should lead to other mitzvos, mitzvah shouldn't lead to restrictions on mitzvos, right? This is a technicality, it's not fair. So Moshe hears them, he hears their argument, he takes it to Hashem, and Hashem's maskim, they shouldn't miss out. Ish ki yet tamei lanefesh, ovederech rechoka lachem oledaroseichem, v'asa pesach l'Hashem. And so it was, the establishment of the holy day of Pesach Sheni, 1 month later. Two questions on Pesach Sheni. Number one, why didn't Hashem just give us a halacha of Pesach Sheni? It's not like Hashem didn't see this coming. When teaching Hilchos Pesach, just say, by the way, some people inevitably are going to be excluded from the Karban Pesach because of Tumas Meis, or because Bederach Rechoka, they're in a faraway place. But never fear, I'm giving you Pesach Sheni for these particular people. Why did this have to come about through people complaining, and then Moshe, after the fact, have to go back to Hashem and ask a Shaila? It seems very inefficient. Just give it to us L'chadchila from the beginning. Why did it have to be only through this strange story? And number two, question number two, as we've said, the Mefarshim give several varying answers to who these people were, but in the Psukim themselves, Poshipshat, they are anonymous. Vayihi Anoshim, faceless, nameless Jews who contracted Tumas Meis. And this is in stark contrast to the other example in the Torah of Jews coming before Moshe with a complaint, and Moshe then having to take it back to Hashem for a teretz. When was that? Benos Tzlafchad. Right, the daughters of Tzlafcha, that they should inherit their father in lieu of any sons to be yorish from him, which we read in Pinchas about a month or so from now. Right, so there the Torah tells us exactly who they were, as the pasuk says there, mefurish benos Tzlafcha ben Chefer ben Gilad ben Machir ben Menashe lemishpachos Menashe ben Yosef ve'elah shmos benosav machla noah chagla milka v'sirtza. There we know their names. In contrast, why here is it kept a secret? Anoshim, very cryptic. So we'll answer them in order. To question number one, why such an inefficient process to teach us a halacha that Hashem always intended to give? So Rashi answers the question, says very famously, Uriruya haisa parsha zu lemor alidei Moshe, kishar kola Torah kula, ela, meaning Moshe should have taught this, like everything else, ela, shezachu elu shetei omer al yideihen, shemegal gigalin zchus al yidei zaka, right? In the zchus of these anoshim, having that intense desire that we've been talking about, to not miss out on even one iota of Torah, to have a, you know, that deep a desire to leave nothing behind, because of that zchus, the Torah waited to learn Pesach Sheni through them. It was a reward for this mita that they had. All right, very nice. So we should always strive to embody that passion ourselves. But what about question number two? Right, this answer, if you think about it, this answer to question number one almost strengthens question number two. That if they indeed had this chus to have Pesach Sheni taught through them, why? Because of their tremendous passion for Torah, to chas v'shalom have anything left behind that doesn't involve them, why not say who they are? We should have a parade for them. They should be, you know, famous. They should be big tzaddikim. Why the anonymity? So to this, there's an amazing idea from Rav Moshe Feinstein in Darash Moshe on the Parsha. And he says as follows. The normal reaction for their scenario would be, normal. Well, we're Tamei, right? We're Tamei. We touched a dead body. We came in contact with a dead body. So for Karban Pesach, we're off the hook. We're Potter. And that's that. But for these Anoshim, that was not that. And if their names would have been mentioned, if the Torah would have told us who they were, we, as learners of the Torah, as observers to this story, would say that this attitude came about. They had this attitude because they're big tzaddikim. They're big tzaddikim. We know their names. They're big tzaddikim. Versus me, the reader, the observer, I'm not like that. But no, says Rav Moshe, we dafka don't mention their names in the Torah to show that these were regular people. Not big tzaddikim, not the gedolei hador. But what made them special? Their tshuka, their passion for mitzvos, for Torah. And so too with us, other regular people, halavai, that we should never say that the Torah is the Torah, and the actors in that story were lofty pillars of our religion who I personally can never live up to. That's the wrong attitude. We should always live our lives feeling that we can achieve the same milas as our ancestors. Whether we can or cannot is irrelevant, but we should always strive for that. All we need to have is a passion, a cheshek to never miss out, a ratzon to live a life of Torah, besimcha and ba'ava, just like these anoshim. And if we do that, Rav Moshe writes, it's ki'ilu the Torah is being given again through us, right? It's being given through us all over again. So mitzvah Hashem, we should have that siyata d'shmaya to live this way, and embody this tremendous yisod of Pesach Sheni, to have that kind of consistent energy and focus. And in that schus, we should receive nothing but bracha and atzlacha in all of our endeavors. All right, next. A short idea, but a very important one. So the pasuk in this week's parsha describes and introduces us to the chatzotzros, the trumpets of Moshe Rabbeinu. Asei lecha shtei chatzotzros kesef miksha ta'asel son vayulecha lamikra edal umasos amachanos. Two silver trumpets, and their primary function when blown by the Kohanim was to assemble all of Klal Yisrael together. So as we described earlier, when did they assemble? Under what scenarios? There are a few scenarios given by the psukim. When it was time to pick up and move camp, to travel. As we all know, the pasuk says, Al-pi Hashem yachnu, v'al-pi Hashem yiso. They traveled when Hashem said to travel, and they went where Hashem said to go. So the chatzotzros announced that, you know, Hashem has said, let's go, so let's go. And number two, also we have, Ki savo milchama ba'artzachem, al-atzar atzarer eschem, v'hariosem b'chatzotzros. When they assembled to go to war against an enemy. All right, so that makes sense. And number three, biyom simchaschem v'moadechem v'roshei chodshechem usikatem b'chatzotzros alaloseichem v'yalzivchei shalmeichem, right, on Yontiv and on Rosh Chodesh for your karbonos tzibor, olos and shlomim, you know, all of those happy and festive days. So ask the Shemin HaTov, Rav Weinberger from Brooklyn, Olav Shalom, who we've quoted many, many times in this Chabura, one of my, best finds in terms of a Parsha Sefer in the past year or so. Why are the Chatzotzros blown for war and for Yontif? That's his question. Why are Chatzotzros blown for war and for Yontif? Right? You couldn't have two events more opposite from each other. War is a call to arms, a time of tremendous anxiety and fear, versus Yontif is a time of simcha and excitement and celebration. Why at both do we find the same trumpets? Right? How can the same chatzotzros be associated with both war and simcha? They don't seem compatible. So in other words, what's the panemius of these chatzotzros, and what can we as simple Jews learn from here? That's the question we ask on every single idea we give in this chabura. What's the panemius, and what can we as simple Jews learn from it? So answer is the Shemen HaTov. What's the link between war and simcha, between tragedy and triumph, between fear and celebration? What's the link between these polar opposites such that the chatzotzros make appearances by both? Hashem. Hashem is the link. Both good times, b'yom simchaschem uv'moadechem, and bad times, ki savo milchama, are sent by the same Hashem. And both are ultimately for our benefit. The blowing of the trumpets by both, the blowing of the chatzotzros by both milchama and b'yom simchaschem, the uniformity of it, the synergies between the two events represents that fundamental truth. Right? Too often, when things are good, we say, Hashem loves me, Hashem is with me. But when times are seemingly not so good, we instinctively feel like Hashem has left us. Right? That's what we tend to resort to. Not so. The same Hashem that gives us b'yom simchaschem uv'moadechem also gives us sometimes, unfortunately, ki savo milchama. And that should be a tremendous comfort for us, a tremendous nechama for us to always find Hashem, always find that kol demama daka, right, to use a chatzotzros, a shofar term, to always find the hashkacha of Hashem contained in the tkios and the truos, no matter what's happening in our lives. It's all from Hashem, and ultimately it's all for our own benefit. And ends the Shemen HaTov here, he gives a bracha for all of us, that if we blow the trumpets in times of good, in times of simcha and celebration, b'yom simchaschem v'moadechem, and we give hakaras HaTov to Hashem for all he's given us, then Amir Tzashem, we shouldn't have much occasion to blow these chatzotzros in times of war and sadness and fear. So Amir Tzashem, we can indeed embody this attitude. Number one, because it's a tremendous psychological boost to help us get through tough times, because knowing that Hashem is behind it all. But moreover, it's the way Hashem wants us to be. It's the way we're supposed to think, because it's the truth. So Amir Tzashem, we should be zocha to tremendous kochos to be able to do this. And Amir Tzashem, be zocha to all the brachos of the chatzotzros, to smachos, and to Moadim every day of our lives. All right, next idea. I'd like to talk tonight for a few minutes about Moshe Rabbeinu. And we're going to follow the rule that we talk about on Pesach every year, but it's a general rule of Maskil Bignus Umisayim Bishvach. Right, one idea that paints him in a powerful light of imperfection and scrutiny and what that teaches us. And then maybe if there's time, a beautiful story and a mashal that I think sheds another light onto a less discussed aspect of Moshe Rabbeinu's experience as leader of Klal Yisrael and what lesson we could take away from that for us as individuals. But then we'll end off Misayim Bishvach with a description and an analysis of Moshe being the most chashuv human being of all time, right? The Pasuk says, V'lo kam navi od b'Yisrael kemoshe. And here in our parsha, it says also, V'ish Moshe anav me'od mikol ha'adam asher al panei ha'adama. And what exactly that means and what that can teach us as simple people not holding on that level. So let's start with this. Towards the middle of the parsha, Klal Yisrael is picking up to finally leave Har Sinai, and Moshe asks his father-in-law Yisro to come with them to Eretz Yisrael. L'cha itanu ve'tabnu lach. Come with us and it'll be good for you, a bracha. But Yisro says, no, ki im el arzi ve'el molati elech. I have to get back to my family. But Moshe insists, no, al na tazov osanu ki al kenya data chanosenu bamidbar v'yisolanu le'noyim. Don't go, because you know the desert better than anyone. You know all the advantages of every spot. And it would be a big help to us if you would stay as a guide. And he repeats it again, Ve'tabnu lach. It'll be a bracha to you if you come with us. Fine. That's the exchange between Moshe and Yisro. And the Torah doesn't say if Yisro came or not. It's not Mefurish. Most Mefarshim say he did come. Versus the Svarno famously says that Yisro went back to Midian, but his children stayed with Klal Yisrael. And they became the inhabitants of the city of Yericho. He actually brings a pasuk in Shoftim to show this. So from this dialogue, Rav Shamshon Raphael Hirsch says something that personally I'd be afraid to say myself, but he says it. An extremely bold and biting critique of Moshe Rabbeinu. He says as follows, if you noticed, Moshe at first says, come because it's going to be good for you. But then when Moshe refuses, he changes it and says, it'll be good for you still, it'll still be good for you, but, and we need your expertise to navigate the terrain as easily as possible. Chanosenu bamidbar, v'hayisa lanu le'inayim. So Rav Hirsch says, look how much chashivus Moshe affords to the council of Yisro, his father-in-law. Back in Parshas Yisro, he takes his advice regarding the Zganim, and here again, he needs his help to navigate the desert. What do we see? Says Rav Hirsch, again, I'd be afraid to say this, but this is what Rav Hirsch says, that Moshe, as great as a Navi as he was, as great a Talmud Chacham as he was, as big an Anav as he was, which we'll discuss in a minute, Moshe was not very good at organizing and actually guiding and leading the people. He couldn't manage the workload. As we'll see in a minute, he tells Hashem he's overwhelmed. And he couldn't organize things that well. And yes, ultimately, of course, Klal Yisrael was guided by Hashem. But the Torah stresses that Moshe felt lost on his own and was much more comfortable under the counsel of Yisro. So two things we learn from this. The Torah is stressing to us the faults of Moshe Rabbeinu, that, you know, he wouldn't have made a great hire as an office manager. Let's call it that. Why? So let's see what Rav Hirsch says. Ish ze lo yachol haya lahanig es amo v'lo seis lo satora me'atzmo haya biyado lasos kein rak kikli sharis biyad Hashem. Number one, to show that Moshe, given his lack of natural leadership and organizational skill, that he always looked to the counsel of others first, such a person had no shot whatsoever of being successful here. No shot of leading Klal Yisrael out of Mitzrayim and giving them the Torah unless he was only acting as a kli, a vessel of Hashem. So too with us. We need to recognize that very often we may lack the skills that it takes to really accomplish something, but somehow we do. And that somehow is Hashem. We need to be makir tov for that. And number two, this shows us again, as we see very often, the Torah goes out of its way to show us the weaknesses of its heroes, right? Other religions portray their leaders as inscrutable and infallible and perfect in every way, and that's because they are religions of man, of humanity. So you need a lot of, heavy editing in order to create that image. But not so with Yiddishkeit, right? Avram sinned when he said Sarah was his sister. And Yitzchak, the Mefarshim say, wasn't sensitive to the chinuch needs of Yaakov versus Esav. And Aaron's involvement in the Egel, David and Bathsheba, Yonah fleeing away from Hashem from Nineveh. The list goes on and on. And yes, even Moshe Rabbeinu had flaws, right? By May Meriva. And we highlight them. Dafka to teach us this lesson, that the Torah was built for mankind. And no man is perfect. So the Torah is brutally honest with us. The Yesod is, and we need to understand this, it's okay for us to have flaws. We're not perfect. Just as long as we keep striving, just as long as we keep trying to enrich ourselves above and beyond our inherent shortcomings. That's what the Avos did, and that's what Moshe did. That's what all of our heroes successfully did. So that's the maschil bignus of Moshe Rabbeinu based on Rav Hirsch. As a side point to this, just because I wouldn't do this if I was giving the chabura in person because I'm up against Maariv, but here I have no time limit, so I'll quick side point. I heard a great idea from Rav Yossi Zakatinsky several years ago. We're discussing Moshe Rabbeinu based on his dialogue with Yisro as having flaws, having poor organizational skills, being unable to cope. Well, that's reflected in another instance in our parsha too, right? When Klal Yisrael later on complained to Moshe about having only the man, they wanted meat too. This was the straw that broke the camel's back. Moshe's fed up. Lama hariyosa lavdecha v'lama matzasi chen beinecha lasum es masa kala'am hazel lai. Why have you, Hashem, treated me so badly and placed this whole burden on me? He anochi harisi es kala'am hazeh im anochi litiyu? Right? Did I give birth to these people? Lo chal anochi levadi laseses kala'am hazeh ki chavei bimeni. This burden has become way too heavy for me. And like we said in the beginning, im kacha at oseli hargeni na harog. If this is how it's going to be, better off just kill me. It's pretty extreme stuff for Moshe Rabbeinu. Again, showing his flaws, his occasional inability to cope with the people, to manage the people, and to keep things organized. But Hashem doesn't say, all right, Moshe, I'll kill you. Of course not. No, Hashem gives him an Eitzah to cope. Hashem gives him Chizuk. What was that Eitzah? What was that Chizuk? Esfoli shivim ish. Gather to yourself the 70 Zakenim that you trust and who are worthy people, good Jews, visyatzvu sham imach, and they'll help you carry the burden of the people as a formal, Sanhedrin. V'nasu itcha b'masa'am lo sisa talavadecha, so that you, Moshe, don't have to do everything alone. And so it was. For the rest of Moshe's life, we don't see anywhere in the Torah that describing any more complaints, any more of this inability to manage things. It seems like this suggestion of the Zakenim from Hashem worked. Shkoyach, it solved the problem for Moshe Rabbeinu. Now, let me ask you something about these zakenim, a very powerful question that Rav Zakatinsky asked. Where does the Torah tell us anything about what the zakenim actually did, practically, in terms of leadership? All we know about their job description is that what Hashem tells Moshe here in our psukim, that they would, that these zakenim would be there for. They would be there to help prop him up, to help him cope, to serve as a Sanhedrin. But we don't see written anywhere, described anywhere in the psukim, that they actually did it, that they actually took on practical leadership responsibilities, right? The Torah Vayter still seems to say that it was all Moshe going forward from here, but now all of a sudden he seemed to be okay with it. So what changed, right? The Zakenim were there, but we don't see in the Psukim that they were doing anything. It seems to still be all about Moshe. So Zakatinsky used this as a source in the Torah for the value. The Torah is teaching us the value of having a chevra, of having friends. That when Moshe Rabbeinu felt isolated, like he was alone on an island, the job was overwhelming to him. But when Hashem told him to form a chevra, form a support system of the Zakenim, even if they don't do Moshe's job for him, which we see in the Psukim that they don't, all of a sudden, just by having them there by his side, made the same challenges of being the leader of Klal Yisrael much more tolerable. It gave Moshe a spiritual strength, a certain boost of kochos that he didn't have before. And like we said, we don't see this complaint from Moshe the rest of his life. And so too, this should be a lesson for all of us as well. If we actively connect to other Jews, if we avoid living on an island, like may be our inclination from time to time, if we pursue having a chevra, and if we ensure always that that chevra is strong and genuine and focused on good things, even if they can't live our lives for us, even if they can't solve our problems for us, what they do accomplish is make the challenges of life, whether in Ruchnius or even in Gashmius, become much more manageable. And they inspire and allow us to climb to heights in Torah and Ruchnius and Chesed and Mitzvos that we may not have been able to reach on our own. So Mir Tashem, we should all be Zoche to receive that bracha, the bracha that's stressed here, the bracha of friendship. That's a nice idea I heard from Rav Zakatinsky, also parallel and tangential to this idea about Moshe Rabbeinu. All right, so until now we've painted Moshe Rabbeinu with a very distinct brush of imperfection. So now let's move to the other side of the coin, and as we're supposed to be, we're supposed to be Messiah B'Shvach. So let's be Messiah B'Shvach. We know famously at the end of the Parsha, the Pasuk declares, "Va'ish Moshe Anav Me'od Mikol Adam Asher Al Pnei Adama." Moshe was the most humble person of all time. And the question is, how can that be so, right? Doesn't make any sense. Given his unique level of nevuah, him being the leader of Klal Yisrael, him speaking to Hashem at will, performing miracles right and left, how can it be that he thought lowly of himself? He must have known that he wasn't like the Stam Jew who clearly wasn't performing miracles or doing these things all the time. And the Rambam says very clearly, right, the seventh of the Ikari Emuna, Va'yisod Hashvi Nevuas Moshe Rabbeinu. It's a foundational issue of our religion to believe that no human being was ever or will ever be like Moshe Rabbeinu. Right? No other human being approaches his level. If you don't believe that, you're not Bikaris. This is one of the Ikare Emuna. And Moshe must have known this too. So very simply, how is it possible that Moshe knew he was the greatest human being of all time? He wasn't an Apikoros. And still, he was so humble. In fact, the most humble person of all time, as the Torah says. They seem to be mutually exclusive. So a famous answer, brought by many Mepharshim, but I brought it here, if you're following along in the Mar Makomos, from the Kedushas Levi, Rav Levi Mibridirchev, and alluded to by the Chafetz Chaim. I'm on the bottom of page Gimel, if you're following along the Mar Makomos. And they both really say that humility on Nivus doesn't mean thinking lowly of yourself, right? Moshe knew he had strengths and milas that nobody else had. He wasn't ignorant of that. But at the same time, he benchmarked himself not against other human beings, but against Hashem. And someone who sees Malachim and the Kisei HaKavod and the Shechina itself, like Moshe Rabbeinu did, knows that he's nothing in comparison. And his personality, the personality of Moshe Rabbeinu embodied that truth. That yes, he had milas, yes, he had abilities, but in comparison to Hashem, when you see the infinite vastness of Kedusha, there's no reason to bask in whatever accomplishments he had in this world. That was the source of his humility. And so too, there should be a lesson for us. Humility doesn't mean saying, I'm nothing, I'm dirt. It's not so. That's not what Anivos is. One should feel happy and take pride in his accomplishments. One should recognize his strengths and abilities, and one should have self-esteem and feel good about yourself. But those accomplishments and those acknowledgments shouldn't bring him to a place of gaiva and arrogance and covet-seeking, right? Because if you look upward, if you look at Hashem, if you look at what Hashem is and how small I am in comparison, if you embody a good dose of perspective, you know, what right do I have to develop an arrogant personality? What right do I have to seek kavod, bichlal? That's true anivus, and that was the greatness of Moshe Rabbeinu. So that's from the Kedushas Levi and also the Chafetz Chaim. Another answer is discussed at length in the Mesilas Yesharim, but really it's a mission. It's based on a mission in Avos. Im lamadet Torah harbe, if you learn a lot of Torah, al tachzik tova latzmecha ki lekachna tzarta. Right? If you learn a lot of Torah, don't get arrogant about it, because it was for that purpose that you were created in the first place. You're just doing your job. You're just doing what you're supposed to be doing. So too with Moshe Rabbeinu. Yes, he was the greatest of all time. But that's only because Hashem gave him the kelim, gave him special talents and said, okay, Moshe Rabbeinu, use these talents to become the greatest human being of all time. And so he did. But what right did that give him to be arrogant? Lekach notzarta. He just did his job. If another Jew had his talents provided to him by Hashem, if another Jew had been chosen for this mission, they'd be the greatest Jew of all time, because it would have been their job instead of his. So with this attitude, if you have that attitude, humility, anivus, comes very naturally. So too with us. Whatever skills we have, it's because Hashem gave it to us to do a job in this world. If we do it, great. We should. That's great. We're doing our job. But to be arrogant about it is craziness, right? We're just doing our job. And Hashem could have very easily given our abilities and our accomplishments to someone else. We should always be aware of that. It's a very healthy attitude all around. And finally, one last point that I saw attributed to the Chafetz Chaim. You know, as you all know, very often I usually don't talk about ideas unless I could provide it in writing, and I can provide the Maror Makomos, but unfortunately I couldn't find this written in the Chafetz Chaim, but I heard it, b'shem the Chafetz Chaim, that yes, Moshe was the greatest human being of all time, but Dafka, because that was so, because he was the greatest human being of all time, he was expected to exhibit that greatness with regard to all positive character attributes, including anivus, humility. And so too with us. Greatness comes with an achrayus, right? Having talents and accomplishments compels us to extend those talents and accomplishments to all of the important areas of life, including humility. So if you want to be great, do so. Be great. Go get it. But do so across the board. And that's what Moshe Rabbeinu did. He was the greatest Navi of all time, the greatest human being of all time, but he extended that greatness to humility as well. He was well rounded in the Indian of greatness. So Mitzvah Hashem, we should all be zoche to all the wonderful brachos life has to offer, but to use those brachos to model the tremendous anava of the greatest human being of all time, of Moshe Rabbeinu, alav hashalom. So that's a portrait of Moshe Rabbeinu, both on the gnus side and on the shvach side. All right. Unfortunately, one of the main storylines of this parsha is the infamous story of the Misonanim. How immediately after beginning their travels away from Har Sinai, Klal Yisrael began to complain. And we've already discussed the inverted nuns a bit tonight, what they represent on a deeper level as a separate book unto itself, bracketing in Vayihi ben Soa. But at face value, we have another shita in the Gemara in Shabbos on Kuf Tes Vav Amud Beis that discusses this point. Or there's another shita here of Shimon Gamaliel says, why are the nuns here? Kedei lahafzik bein peronios rishon leperonos shnia, to separate between the two tragedies that shouldn't have one bad thing right after another. That's why we have Vayihi ben Soa and the inverted nuns, to separate between these two peronios, that we shouldn't have them right after each other. So the second peronios, the second calamity, I understand. It's the Misonanim that come right after Vayihi ben Soa and the nuns. But what's the peronios, the calamity that came before it? So says the Gemara, Vayisume Har Hashem, They traveled away from Har Sinai. V'omer b'chama b'chanina shisaru me'achar Hashem. They hurriedly traveled away from Har Shem and Har Sinai. They ran away. And Tosfos there on that on the Gemara says ketino kayotze mibeis sefer. A very famous line, like a kid in school when the bell rings. You know, he is out of there when that bell rings. And so too, that's how Klal Yisrael acted leaving Har Sinai. They were way too eager. And that's the first Puranios that precedes Vayehi ben Soa. So a side point, I'm sure it's not coincidental that this parsha is read right around the time that our schools, Mamish, let out for the summer. And to teach us that we should never be so eager to leave an environment of Torah. If it's time to go, if it's Bein Hazmanim, go. But we don't need to run. You know, because yeshiva, the base medrash, is supposed to be a place that we run to, not away from. Just a quick piece of mussar for all of us to chew on. But, you know, real, I was thinking about this, just another phenomenal example of the living nature of the Jewish calendar and the Seder HaParshios to fit that. And the question is, getting back to our topic, the question is, and this is posed by Rav Shimon Schwab in Mayan Beis HaShoeva, I understand that when they complained, this was a tragedy, and they were punished accordingly, says the Pasuk, Vativar bam Eish Hashem, Vatochal b'ksei ha-machane. There was a terrible fire on the outskirts of the camp. But when they ran away from Har Sinai, when the bell rung, where's the repercussions for that? I don't see any peronios there. I don't see any punishment. So Schwab says, that in itself, being so close to Kedusha, not letting it fully sink in, and then running away from it without getting the most out of it, getting the most you possibly could have obtained, he says, ki achet ba'atzmo hu ha'onesh. In and of itself, that was a tremendous self-inflicted wound on par with the Eish Hashem by the Misonanim later on, right? Klal Yisrael here, says Rav Schwab, showed a lack of hakaras hatov and a lack of basic love for the Torah and the tremendous spiritual growth they had just received as a gift not so long ago by Har Sinai. And in doing so, they punished themselves. They punished themselves. So this by itself should serve as a lesson to all of us, to never lose our appreciation for what the Torah is, and never lose our appreciation for what it provides for us on a daily basis. To never, chas v'shalom, run away from it, like Tosfos says, ketino kayotze mibeis ha-sefer. And finally tonight, on the same topic of the Misonanim, we know at first the complaints were very generic, right? The desert travel is too difficult. It was basic, kvetchiness. But then it develops and takes form. And Klal Yisrael targets something specific. What was it? The Pasuk says, Mi achilenu basar. We want meat. Who's giving us meat? And other foods too. Zacharnu es hadaga, asher nochal b'mitzrayim chinam, es hakishuim, v'yesu avatichim, v'yesu hechotzir, v'yesu habitzolim, v'yesu hashumim. We don't like the menu. We don't like the menu. Why? Why don't they like the menu? V'ata nafshenu yivesha ein kol, bilti al haman einenu. We're sick of the man. We're sick of the man. It's dried out our bodies, right? Nafshenu yivesha, right? And so forth. It says Netziv. Netziv says, based on the Ramban, what were they really complaining about? What was the crux, the pnimius of their sudden gripe with the man? Says Netziv, they were sick of having to... They weren't sick of the mun per se. They weren't sick of its taste or of its, the nature of the food itself. That's not what their real complaint was. It says in the Tziv, they were sick of having to rely on it each day. They wanted meat because meat, you've got a fixed supply and you know what you have, likely several weeks or months or even years worth of meat if you can freeze it. And then you feel like you're in control of your life versus the mun. Right? The mun spoiled after a day if you gathered it up, and they had to rely on it every day. Every morning they had to go and collect it. The mun reminded them every single day when they had to wait eagerly to see it fall that they were not in control. And these misonanim, these complainers, they were sick of it. Right? And the Tziv says, V'lohayu tzrichim shiyu einayim tluyos im yered lamachar. The anxiety, the nervousness. Would it come today? Would it not come today? Would it come tomorrow? Would it not come tomorrow? If it doesn't, what am I going to do? We're in a desert. We'll die of starvation and so forth. They were sick of all the gray hairs that the mun was giving them. And they wanted the manner by which Hashem provided for them to change to a system where they felt more in control of their own destiny. So here's the key point, though, and the Tziv highlights this. This is what they were thinking, that we don't want to feel reliant on Hashem anymore, right? But you see, to verbalize that, to actually say it, that sounds terrible. That sounds really bad. That makes them sound like awful Jews with no emunah whatsoever. And they knew that. They knew it, that they couldn't verbalize it. And that made these misonanim, these complaining Jews, feel tremendous busha. They had tremendous embarrassment to actually say it. The chutzpah, can you imagine? After everything Hashem had done for them. So they couldn't say it outright. So what did they do? Says in the Tziv, Mishum hachi chafsho alila cheres lomar shetayva nafsham lebosar. They buried it. They coated it. They morphed it into something more benign, that we really love meat and fish and kishu and cucumbers and watermelon and leeks and onions and garlic, the whole smorgasbord from Mitzrayim. We miss it. But as Netziv points out, you know, the man was delicious. There was no problem with the man as food. That wasn't really their complaint. That was only code for, we don't want to rely on Hashem anymore. So the Yesod's as follows, and with this we'll conclude for tonight. You know, as Jews, as members of the Am Skula Mikol Amim, we're all held to a higher standard. Yes, would it be nice to have the next 50 years of Parnassa just appear on our doorstep tomorrow morning? Absolutely. Would it be nice to have all the brachos in the world, health and wealth and shidduchim and children and hasmada and Torah? Wouldn't it be great to just have it grow on trees and just get it all one day as a pure gift, to have it just fall into our laps? Unquestionably. But to demand that, like the Misonanim did here in the Midbar, and thereby to despise the very notion of having to daven for it, to work for it with Torah and mitzvos and accumulating zchusim, to reject that process and just want it, is a rejection of the hashgach of Hashem. And shame on us if we stoop to that terrible, terrible place. As Jews, we need to, like I said, we need to abide by a higher standard, to certainly strive for all the greatest brachos of this world and the next world, to strive for all of the best things that these worlds have to offer. But all of that seeking and all of that striving, all of it, you know, must always be under the construct of emunah and bitachon and tefillah and maintaining that around-the-clock relationship with the Borei Olam. And if we can do that, if we're constantly checking in with ourselves to ensure that we're behaving in that manner, to keep that proper perspective and not fall into the trap of the Misonanim, who just wanted the easy route as an excuse to deem Hashem's hashkacha in their lives as irrelevant. Right? If we keep working on this, we should be zocha, genuinely zocha, not to the brachos of meat and cucumbers, but to the brachos of the man. And that being the warmest and most constant of relationships with Hashem. And with that, I wish everyone a very, very good Shabbos.